morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Memorial Day was first established as a single day of national mourning for America's war dead, with a powerful element of jingoism inherent in its Go West, Young Manifest Destiny paean, inspired by the Civil War in which everyone killed on either side or subsumed in between was an American, including slaves for whom the war manifested its public rationale. For more than a century, Memorial Day was on May 30th, from 1868 to 1970. If we are to honor Memorial Day, we should do it for real and return it to a single day of commemoration, as it was traditionally, rather than a three-day weekend commercial bacchanal that makes a mockery of the nation's war dead, or at the very least a sideshow for cash register-sponsored partying, which seems quite macabre this year of plague that has killed more Americans than the total of every war since World War II. This Saturday is May 30th, the original Memorial Day, and today's program is about soldiers, past and present, dead or alive. I wrote it as a patchwork inspired by several previous articles I wrote for the North Coast Times-Eagle, so every fault or flaw is mine. I call it Yankee Doodle Dead. The most shamelessly exploited minority in American society is its war dead. They died horribly, and most of them unwillingly, but they are not left to rot in peace. Their molding, mutilated corpses are eloquently exhumed as spearheads for the next war, their deaths extolled to recruit new armies. A language of lies develops. The dead always died for their country, heroically and nobly, and all of them willingly made the publicly acclaimed final sacrifice. None raped, pillaged, or burned, or committed other than sanctioned murder or terrorism. None died because of simple bad luck, or from their own stupidity, or that of their commanders, or from callous or asinine battle strategies. None died from accidental shelling or bombing by their own side. All of them were killed facing the enemy, not running away or cowering in fear or horror. Their deaths are glorified as justifications for the wars that killed them. Nations are haunted by their war dead. Monuments and memorials are built in every city and somewhere near the center of every town. The war dead assume a purity in death most would have found difficult to attain in life. The official piety is that the cultural lifeblood is sustained by their deaths rather than drained, and only by sacrificing themselves in the same manner will the living gain a similar historical legitimacy. Service to the state is always a possibility to the young, and death in its service is presented as an ideal or an unavoidable necessity. Families of the dead who should protest the slaughter of their young are instead consenting accomplices in the maxim that warfare is the only response to an unruly world. Those who resist that specious reasoning are compared to the heroic dead as unworthy cowards and traitors, implicitly responsible for their deaths. The irony of war deaths exploited as coercion for others to also murder and die is lost in the clamorous thunder of voices shouting for vengeance and righteous war. War survivors are used as shabbily as the dead. They are given parades and empty honors. The horror of their experiences is shielded from public view, gold-plated in boilerplate and pageantry. Yet they are undeniably representative of humanity's dark side that civilization attempts to disregard or abstract, even while perpetuating it through them. War is blood, carnage, and death, which is so obvious a fact we too often ignore it in our preoccupation with the rationales, strategies, weapons, and machines of war. Each generation seems to think it should not be outdone by its predecessors. It must leave its bloody mark on history, no matter how absurd or pointless. Every generation has been incapable or unwilling to arrest the pattern of terror and suffering each inflicts on itself, and our own risks world holocaust because of a compulsive insistence that our time, which is noteworthy only because we live in it, be no less dramatic than the histories we distortedly imitate. Our mental evolution of the past 10,000 years has not eradicated the savagery or the terror of our most primitive ancestors. We continue to regard every other human, and by extension, other cultures, nations, religions, and races, our blood enemies. We continue to war or think of war as our right to dominate or destroy whoever is weaker, different, or in the way. Humanity's history is of wars. The most fierce and acquisitive sweep away the gentle and least avaricious. It was that way when our hairy ancestors thrust pointed sticks into each other. It is that way now, when the weapons of our industry are able to reduce continents to radioactive ash in minutes. The only real significance of the eternal conflicts of our species is the epic flow of blood, the slaughter of millions at each turn of history's gory pages for reasons as brief as their lives. The names of the multitudes are lost. Only their numbers are haphazardly marked, aggregates of killers and killed. Looking at history only through the bloody prism of war is to miss much of the best of it and distorts it. Yet wars shape nations and individuals. Much of what each claims as heritage and honor is bequeathed by war. Waging war is a nation's most serious business. Until recently, the highest honors a nation or people could bestow were upon the men who draped themselves in the blood of others. Life's heroes have always been the men of death. War has advanced civilization as brutally as it has destroyed civilizations. Humanity is as accustomed to warfare as breathing and copulating. We are a killing species. We dominate Earth because our raptor ancestors were clever, ruthless, and well-organized predators, and we have butchered our own as readily as any other creature. As humanity became more settled and civilized, the laurels inevitably transcended from the stealthy hunters of animals to the slayers of human beings. All of our great civilizations and empires have been structured on the expenditure of human blood, the conquest and often decimation of tribes, cities, or nations, unlucky to be along the march of more ambitiously militant societies. Every war can be traced back centuries. Eventual antipathy beneath a contemporary surface of conflict, religious and or racial at its root. The most devastating and never forgiven wars are essentially religious-based, holy wars, crusades, jihads, whatever they may be called. And it seems that every century has an explosive recurrence among the same theological combatants. The cusp of millennium seemed to stir apocalyptic prophecies to greater carnage to obliterate opposing theologies. The last millennium in 1000 AD sparked holy wars between East and West that lasted three centuries and never really ceased. This millennium started ominously, a surprise assault on the foremost tempers of Christian capitalism by radical Islamists. The devastating and unprecedented attack against the United States on September 11, 2001 was not directed at the World Trade Center and Pentagon, and perhaps a failed attempt on the White House, as mere symbols of American power, but instead as the true center of the USA's political, economic, and military global supremacy. That was clearly the perspective of those who elaborately planned and executed the attacks, converting passenger-filled airliners into suicide bombs. The terrorists regarded those employed in those two centers, and surely the White House, as directly responsible for American military, political, and monetary actions around the world, as our U.S. soldiers, diplomats, and multinational corporations based in the USA. Although Americans like to think of themselves as a peaceable society, we are among history's more aggressively warlike, inspired by a manifest destiny to create a worldwide quasi-empirical experiment based theoretically on its ideals of liberty and equality, but more truthfully on its general practices of missionary militancy and seemingly obverse appetite for wealth and power. The American nation was conceived by war, preserved its union by war, became a continental power by invading Mexico and cutting off its head, and acquired world influence by seizing the feeble remnants of Spain's decrepit colonial empire, which, at its defeat, was confined to a few ocean islands. The USA became a superpower by fighting two world wars in which it built a war machine unsurpassed in history, while demonstrating a productive capacity that overwhelmed enemies and allies alike. The United States has fought a dozen major wars, which must include the incessant three-century extermination of Native American civilization that is comparably among the most savage and genocidal campaigns ever fought. This pervasively ambitious expansion across the North American continent inflamed the concept of manifest destiny, which necessitated in the minds of the manifest expansionists the continued annihilation of the primeval tribes, whose desperately brave but pitiful resistance against cultural extinction was no match for the weaponry of the Industrial Revolution and the determination to possess their homelands. To this purpose, in addition to indiscriminate obliteration of any tribe within reach, was the use of disease, the deliberate spread of smallpox and cholera among tribes who might more adequately defend their homelands than others. At the beginning of the 20th century, the U.S. fought for control of its new Pacific Ocean empire by slaughtering Filipinos, who mistakenly hoped their liberation from Spain would result in independence. They resisted their new masters with a bitter insurgency that, in length and furious response of attrition, was a precursor of the Vietnam War 60 years later. In the 1920s, similar tactics were used in a series of banana wars in Latin America and the Caribbean, in which Yankee Doodle imperialist gringos set up brutal puppet regimes that managed U.S. economic interests with death squads and iron political control for nearly a century. The wars the USA has fought since its revolutionary liberation from European colonial imperialism have been as much about manifest destiny as about democracy and the Bill of Rights. The soldiers who fight the wars ardently wish to believe they are advancing or defending cherished values of freedom, however manipulated or deceived into that anxious belief. The Civil War was about slavery because that was the essential reason soldiers on both sides fought it, for and against, despite horrendous casualties. World War I was to put an end to warfare because the soldiers slaughtered each other by the millions for that fervent hope. World War II is eulogized as history's most titanic struggle between liberty and justice for all against totalitarian subjugation and genocide. The last living survivors of that Holocaust are honored, as many of them die in this plague pandemic. The wars in Korea and Vietnam were more subjective than their predecessors, so-called brushfire wars, to promote, prevent, or defend the spread of Cold War ideologies and to skirt nuclear oblivion while simultaneously risking it. Both wars were inconclusive to the half-century struggle between Western democracy and Soviet communism, but certainly did not lack inordinate casualties. So, Iraq and Afghanistan. The grunts on the ground and in the air initially clung to a stubborn faith that they were liberating both countries from monstrous regimes and in revenge against the shocking terrorism of 9/11. Yet Americans and their allies faced equally grim tenacity by hardcore insurgent resistance to oust invaders the locals regarded as infidel usurpers, as pernicious as the earlier medieval crusaders of the previous millennium. At the very least, American soldiers, as do all soldiers except perhaps mercenaries, trust that their great personal risks and probable deaths or wounds are for the exalted principles or urgent necessities required of them, and that their leaders honestly keep faith with them. But soldiers have been lied to throughout history. They have always been coerced in one deceitful manner or other to commit and suffer humanity's most hideous iniquities, generally in the names of its most sanctified beliefs. That has not changed. Americans who fought and died in the latest wars in Iraq and Afghanistan were as deceived as to the underlying purposes of those dual wars as were their predecessors of wars immemorial. And the rewards for such guileless intrepidity have been, as always, unequal and disproportionate to the fervent sacrifices for them. The only purpose for armies is the destruction of other human beings. Soldiering is big business, the first order of every empire, nation, or city-state, as it has been since ancient times. But soldiers are themselves little more than expendable pawns, readily discarded. Without soldiers, there would be no wars, as they are at least defined, and there would be, most likely, no Caesars, no Napoleons, no Hitlers. Militarism rules the planet, unfortunately. Military values are taught at every level of education and are incorporated in the root systems of societal values. Militarism is the antithesis of liberty and democracy, and its justice is based on obedience and servitude. The economies of most nations are poured into war machines that posture as defensive instruments, and world leaders blackmail their populations with fear and extortions of terror. Nightmares of doom are disguised as dream worlds of prosperity and survivance. The war parties always attempt to capture patriotism as their own and portray dissent against their wars as sedition and disloyalty. Support for the soldiers acts contrarily as a relentless goad that pushes troops into irreversible horror at the same time that cheering war cries crush any who would conscientiously object. Yet the soldiers we are exhorted to uncritically support can be turned against the citizenry, ordered to suppress dissent, and round up political activists who oppose war. Oregon's great John Reed saw the sinister side of soldiers and anticipated the civic consequence of military jurisdiction. "I hate soldiers," he wrote. "I hate to see a man with a bayonet on his rifle who can order me off the street. I hate to belong to an organization that is proud of being a caste of superior beings, that is proud of killing free ideas so that it may more effectively kill human beings." This is not the currently popular attitude toward members of the armed forces. It is, however, an historically accurate one. The chilling thought is that in this chaotically repressive era of Donald Trump, such brutally lawless use of soldiers would have zealous right-wing support. Armageddon is the shrine of the military profession, the prophesized place for the last battle at the end of the world. Civilizations have profited immensely from wars, and warfare has progressed civilization's expanse and technologies. Yet war has also turned out the lights of civilization. Humanity has been set back centuries for its predilection for war, long periods of decline and retrogression, interminable cycles of darkness. The United States commemorates its war dead on Memorial Day, which is at the end of May. It should be the proper occasion to pierce the illusions and deceptions and remember that the hallowed dead would bitterly protest being used to kill others symbiotic to themselves. "With them in hell," wrote Wilfred Owen, regarded as the best soldier poet of World War I and perhaps the best war poet ever, killed a week before the armistice, "the sorrowful dark of hell, whose world is but the trembling of a flare, and heaven but as the highway for a shell." And now, as epilogue, Anne Bullion, second wife of England's King Henry VIII, was known as Anne of the Thousand Days from her short reign as queen before being beheaded because she was unable to provide the king a son as heir. Her posthumous revenge was that her daughter Elizabeth became England's immortal queen. Anne Frank might be called Anne of the Thousand Years, because although she was a teenage girl when she died in one of Nazi Germany's death camps, just before the defeat of Nazism and the end of World War II in Europe 75 years ago on May 8, 1945, she died of typhus. She merits remembrance for at least a millennium. If a single person embodies the millions who were persecuted and put to death by the Nazis during the infamous Holocaust, it was she, only 15 when she died in March 1945. Her Diary of Anne Frank might be regarded as the most significant book of the 20th century, as well as in all literature. The Holocaust of World War II was not a special instance perpetrated by a rogue psychopathy. It was the long-evolved culmination of centuries of inflamed antipathy, discrimination, and persecution against Jews. Hatred and intolerance are on the rise worldwide at this advent of the third decade of the 21st century, a virulence never at rest, even when periodically subdued by revulsion of its excesses. Falsifiers of history exhort masses to exterminate minorities or inconvenient theologies. Genocide wears a cosmetic of ethnic cleansing, a convenience of attributing fault or connivance for societal ills. Jews were blamed for the Black Death of bubonic plagues 6 centuries previous to the Holocaust and were murdered and slaughtered throughout plague-riven Europe by frightened and enraged victims of the plague. Anne Frank was certainly a victim of the mentally and morally evil plague of Nazism. Thousands more stories and personal accounts of the World War II Nazi Holocaust have emerged these past 75 years, yet Anne Frank's voice remains the most compelling, which is not about the hideous crimes against humanity committed by Nazism, but is instead a young girl's chronicle of hope and compassion beyond the genocide that darkened the human world. Perhaps in succeeding centuries, only 2 names might be remembered from World War II, symbolic of its evil darkness and subsequent brief illumination of goodness: Adolf Hitler and Anne Frank. And now, a poem by Oregon's immortal poet laureate, William Stafford, The End of the War. All violent like the knife that drove the pity begging life out through the eyes, and wilted the choked voice in little cries that bubbled and blinked out along the floor. All hungry like the outlaw stare that tore the north and reeled the rivers in along the spool that never would unwind them anymore to wander cool, but stretched them taut to all that's far away. All lost by dusty roads, all fled with love, all hid along with play, all hurt by what we lost, who conquered in the war, so violent, so lost, so far away. And that was William Stafford, The End of War. And now, a poem by Geoffrey Grigson. After all, white doves, they rose out of dead men, out of their mouths, gently, white doves, to branches where they fidgeted, at first a little, free, uncertainly. It was something, white doves for the souls of men, instead of the roving idiots of the morning, cuckoos, or jackdaws cackling, or identical factory chicken chelping, or worse. White doves, even the souls of the worst. And a poem by Philip Levine, This War, which he wrote in May 1972. You go down to the grave and pound on the roof until the woman answers, the child cries, until the man in his coat of fire opens and you enter, the charred eye flaking into white streams, the voice howling in the darkened subway, the teeth grinding stones until a new wind stirs the thumbs of onions and the purple chives scatter on the grass and the wren comes back. The lights of the slaughterhouse burn all day. No one comes. The old mare waits in the bricked alley, her loose flesh sliding against flies. She sees the cloud pass over, the sun and break against the mountains. you turn to the foothills where the day walks through birch leaves, lifting in surprise. Or no one hears, your knees bang down on the bare floor, your forehead opens and the secrets spill out like mud. No one answers. The mouth of the grave closes, the tongue lopped off at the root, and the last word comes down this spring day, pale ashes overflowing the basin of Los Angeles, a scum on the sea of tears coming down. This is Michael McCusker. A parting note. The ill-fated Ann Bullion's family estate of Heaver has been the home of Astoria founder John Jacob Astor's descendants, a family branch that split off from the reigning New York City Astor dynasty in the late 19th century. If anyone listening wants to know more, look up The Astors and Astoria, a wonderful little booklet written by Vera Whitney Galt from columns she wrote for the Daily Astorian in 1990. It is probably still available through the Clatsop County Historical Society, the Astoria Public Library, and or a couple of Astoria's bookstores. Mrs. Galt died in 1992 and is still missed, certainly by me. I hope no one found this past weekend holiday problematically infectious. Stay safe. Protecting yourself protects everyone else. Happy real Memorial Day.